Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's practice groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Marco J. Lloyd, and I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. Today, we're excited to host the webinar, Is AI Woke? In What Ways and Should We Worry? Featuring Professor Vincent Kontzer, Nicholas Garcia, and Kurt Levy. Our moderator today is Ken Marcus. Ken is the founder and chairman of the Brandeis Center for Human Rights Under Law and former assistant U.S. Secretary of Education for Civil Rights. He's also the chairman of the Federal Society's Civil Rights Practice Group. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. If you have a question at any point in today's program, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues, and all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. With that, Ken, thank you for joining us today, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Marco. Welcome to our distinguished panel and also to our viewers. I'm happy on behalf of the Federalist Society Civil Rights Practice Group to welcome all of you today to what I think will be an exciting topic, the second of the Civil Rights Practice Group's webinars regarding AI. As you may have observed, the public discourse surrounding the arguable dangers of artificial intelligence have included expressed concerns about AI systems' potential to discriminate against racial minorities, women, and other groups said to be disadvantaged. And then more recently, increasing concerns about arguable dangers of woke AI. To the extent that generative AI models learn from large amounts of real-world data, which is primarily gleaned from internet content and thus tends to reflect surrounding cultural views. To some degree, one asks, are political biases in these models present? Are they inevitable? Can they be addressed? And how can they be addressed? Pertinent to the current transition here in Washington, D.C., you may have seen that Elon Musk recently repeated his longstanding warning that current AI models are too, quote, woke and also, quote unquote, politically correct. He said a lot of the AIs that are being trained in the San Francisco Bay Area take on the philosophy of people around them. So he said, you have a woke, nihilistic, in my opinion, philosophy that is being built into these AIs. These are the sorts of concerns that are being debated from multiple perspectives and for which we are delighted to have three experts enlighten and inform us from differing perspectives. Kurt Levy, our first speaker, is known to many of you. In addition to being president of the Committee for Justice, he is also a member of the Civil Rights Practice Group and has been influential in urging this practice group to address this topic. He presented as part of our prior webinar on this issue. What you may not know about Kurt, if you didn't see that episode, is that in addition to being a prominent Washington, D.C. lawyer, he also has two degrees in computer science from Brown University and worked in the field of artificial intelligence and even has a patent in the AI field. Our second speaker, Nicholas P. Garcia, is a senior policy counsel at Public Knowledge, focusing on emerging technologies, intellectual property, and closing the digital divide. Before joining Public Knowledge, Nick served as an assistant district attorney in the investigations division of the Bronx County District Attorney's Office, where he investigated and prosecuted cybercrime, fraud, grand larceny, and organized crime. Our third speaker, Vince Kontzer, is the director of the Foundations of Cooperative AI Lab, professor of computer science, and director of the Foundations of Cooperative AI Lab at Carnegie Mellon University. Previously, he was the Kimberly J. Jenkins Distinguished University Professor of New Technologies and professor of computer science, professor of economics, and professor of philosophy at Duke University. He is also head of technical AI engagement at the Institute for Ethics in AI and professor of computer science and philosophy at Oxford University. Over the course of this program, if you have questions, please feel free to put them in the Q&A box, and we will address questions to the extent time remains at the end. Once again, I welcome our distinguished speakers, and we'll turn to Kurt Levy.
Thank you, Ken. And as you pointed out, I come at this from, you know, really with two hats on. One is from my previous career in AI before law school, you know, when I was a scientist in an AI startup, and then post-law school where I've done a lot of work on civil rights. And, you know, my two hats might sometimes view this problem differently. I think it's interesting that both the left and the right are complaining about the danger of bias in AI. But they're, as again, Ken alluded to, they're focused on very different things. The left is focused mainly on the idea that AI models discriminate against various minority groups when they're making decisions about hiring, lending, bail amounts, facial recognition. The right, on the other hand, is concerned about bias against conservative viewpoints and people in large language models like ChatGPT. And that's our topic today. As Ken pointed out, Elon Musk has made it clear that he thinks that AI models are inheriting a woke mindset from their creators, and that's a problem, if only because it conflicts with being what he calls maximally truth-seeking. Musk says that companies are teaching AI to lie in the name of political correctness. And certainly there's a lot of studies and examples of what seems to be bias against conservative viewpoints. Perhaps the most famous example of political correctness in generative AI is Google's Gemini produced, up until it was corrected, that is, politically correct images. So when a user told it to draw Vikings or our founding fathers, it made them diverse racially and gender-wise. Users who requested images of, say, a white family were turned down. Now, to be fair, Google, you know, once this problem was pointed out, Google quickly corrected the problem. There's also a Brookings study in which ChatGPT was prompted to answer yes or no for whether it supported various political statements, you know, pro and anti-abortion, pro and anti-gun control, illegal immigration, et cetera. And at least when it was consistent, for every issue, it supported the liberal position and rejected the conservative position. And then there's a German academic study that had similar results. David Rosato, a researcher down in New Zealand, published a paper earlier this year in which he applied 15 different political orientation tests to the answers ChatGPT gave. And in 14 of the 15 cases, it tended to lean left. You know, reporters have written about, for example, large language models refusing to write a poem commemorating Donald Trump or Ted Cruz, but they were happy to do so for Fidel Castro and, you know, Representative Ilhan Omar. Politico's tech reporter wrote about the fact that he couldn't get ChatGPT to write a legal brief in favor of overruling the Supreme Court's Obergefell decision, that is the gay marriage decision. Another well-known example, a popular LLM made an argument for having no children, but refused to make an argument for having a large family. And then there's the famous example that Musk has pointed out, language model concluded that misgendering reality TV star Caitlyn Jenner is more dangerous than nuclear war. Seems a little bit extreme. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean that these systems are designed to be biased. So what could be the source of the bias? Well, as Musk alludes to, scientists building these generative AI models have to make choices about what data to use. And, you know, many of these same scientists live in very liberal areas like the San Francisco Bay Area. And even if they're not trying to make the system biased, they may very well have unconscious biases when it comes to picking data. Then also, a lot of these models, before they're actually made public, go through a stage where there is a learning with human feedback. OpenAI says this helps to align their models with, quote, human values, but you can see where there would be a lot of room for bias there. And then the various platforms that are offering these models to us, you know, Google, OpenAI, Meta, you know, it's long been shown that there's some bias, anti-conservative bias in the search results and content moderation of these platforms. So, you know, it wouldn't be unimaginable to think that these platforms may have also built in some bias in the interface between the user and the AI model. Just think about, you know, prohibitions, and virtually all these platforms have prohibitions against hate speech or other types of offensive posts. And that could certainly be one source of bias. I mean, after all, if you generalize about, say, undocumented immigrants, that's usually considered hate speech. But if you generalize about Trump supporters, you know, that isn't hate speech. So, you know, there's an area where I think bias certainly comes in. And there's similar bias in screening for misinformation. But I think the biggest source of bias is likely just the collective bias of the contents of the internet. Generative AI models learn from huge amounts of real world data, primarily gleaned from the internet. And then they, you know, thus they tend to reflect society's cultural values. I think the latest figure I heard is that LLMs are trained on about 85% internet data and about 15% books. And the cultural elites in the media and academia contribute much more to the internet's contents than the average American. And among those elites, Castro probably is more popular than Trump or Ted Cruz. And this problem is actually likely to get worse because, you know, future LLMs will increasingly be trained on data that's made up of AI-generated content. And since it's AI generated, the content itself will have, you know, been subject to these biases. So, you know, I think we tend to blame the platforms. I mean, people get angry at Google or OpenAI. But I think the bias is largely upstream of those platforms. I think, you know, woke AI, to the extent it exists, is just coming from the fact that there's a certain viewpoint which is common among our society's elites. Now, what to do about this all? The last few years has certainly seen a plethora of AI laws and regulations being proposed at a state and federal level, including ones that address the problem the left is concerned about, which is a bias against minorities. And some of these, there hasn't been much success, for better or worse, at enacting AI federal statutes, but there has been some success at the state level. And a lot of, you know, the proposals at the state level involve having to test and certify AI models for no discriminatory effect. But again, this refers to the type of bias that the left is talking about, bias in lending, sentencing, so on and so forth. Do we need similar laws to protect against the biases of woke AI? Well, I mean, my view's always been, at least with the type of bias that the left is concerned with, really govern human decision makers and the tools that they use. You know, perhaps there'll come a time when AI is more than a tool, and when AI can produce, you know, human-like autonomous machines with broad general intelligence, and maybe then the you know, we'll need special laws for AI, but that's many years away at best. And I'd like to think that we also don't need to reinvent the wheel when it comes to bias against conservative viewpoints, but it is less clear how current law would you know, help us in fighting that. But I'm still not a big fan of regulation, because I don't think politicians and bureaucrats understand AI and its risks nearly well enough yet to effectively regulate it. And short of laws, I guess developers are just, you know, should try to ensure that the models they build are exposed to multiple perspectives on controversial topics. I mean, Musk has promised to make his LLM, Grok, maximally truth-seeking, that is, less biased, and I'll leave it to others to judge whether he's succeeded or not, and I better stop there.
Thank you, Kurt. Thank you for that tight 8 minutes, and now we are over to you, Nick Garcia.
Thank you so much, Ken, and thanks again for having me and for the invite to speak here today. So I'm going to cover, I think, a lot of the same things that Kurt talked about a little bit. And so I'll try to like breeze over some of them. I'm going to start off just with definitions and unpacking the question, because that's a, you know, habit as a lawyer and as someone who's trained as a philosopher as well. And so thinking about AI in this context, Kurt was putting a particular emphasis on generative AI and LLMs, and I think that is where most of the focus wants to be. But I think about AI broadly right now, as machine learning and especially as deep learning systems, as being the things that people are worried about, because that's what's the newest. And I think that the generative versus kind of discriminative or decision-making distinction is breaking down a lot right now in both the popular and political discourse, for better or worse. So I think it is important to like keep these things actually grouped together in a sense, because I think we're increasingly seeing people relying on all different kinds of systems, regardless of what the real functional architecture of them was designed to be, for all different kinds of purposes. Like LLMs are becoming a kind of like all-purpose AI system in many contexts. And so I think that's something that we want to worry about, is still like those decision-making functions, even if they're not classifier models, let's say. When we're talking about like what is woke in this, my definition of that would be like pretty easily just something like imbued with socially progressive values or something like that. And so thinking about the question as a whole, I think the question is, are these machine learning systems inherently, or just currently at least, imbued with socially progressive values? Following in the great tradition of lawyers before me, the answer like could easily be, it depends, right? But for the sake of like stimulating the conversation here, I'm going to go ahead and say, no, AI is not woke. I think that because we can see from many of the examples that Kurt gave, that people on the left are worried about and have been worried about for a long time, that people would say AI is not woke when it's providing a discriminatory decision about credit, or when it's making a discriminatory like housing recommendation or job recommendation. It's not woke when it's generating overly sexualized imagery of women in these generative AI image models. And I would actually go as far as to say AI is not woke when it's designed to avoid confronting injustice by like spitting out corporate friendly platitudes instead of answering hard political questions that are put to it. I'd also say it's not woke when it's doing some of the amazing stuff that we see AI do. It's not woke when it's folding proteins that revolutionize medicine. It's not woke when it's modeling climate data to help us steward our planet. It's not woke when it's helping someone write a business plan or understand something that they've read before or study for a test, or even just like write an email to get them a maybe life-changing job opportunity. AI does all of those things also. And I think it would be difficult to say that this is like imbued in one way with values. But at the same time, AI is a technology that maybe more so than any technology we've ever developed reflects our society back onto us and reflects the people that build it. It is fundamentally a comprehension engine. It extracts patterns and connections from that vast quantity of training data that it's exposed to. And like Kurt was talking about, a lot of that is the vast corpus of human knowledge and activity that is the internet, which reflects all of the imperfect, chaotic, flawed, contradictory nature of the society that we live in. So there's well-documented biases and blind spots in all kinds of directions in the training data, on the internet, in the models. And it's almost an old adage at this point, if anything can be old in the realm of AI, to say that like garbage in, garbage out, meaning that if you're using bad data, you get bad outputs. But I think it does go deeper than that. And I'm going to push even further than Kurt did, because I think that there is no such thing as an unbiased, neutral, or objective AI system. All AI systems are designed by people, and they're going to reflect the choices, judgment, and yes, the values of the people who designed them. So the data that is chosen, the parameters and the protocols of training, the assessments and evaluations and benchmarks that are used, those are all points of human intervention and subjective judgment. And I think that they do instill values. So when I say subjective judgment there, by the way, I don't mean to say that there aren't better or worse decisions to be made. There certainly are, but I'm not going to go into the whole moral philosophy of it this afternoon also. But so returning to the prompt and to just wrap up, I think about the last bit, which is like, should we worry? And the answer is yes, I do worry. For me, the worrying question isn't, though, is AI woke? It's because AI is going to be something, right? It's going to have values because it's built by humans, because it's trained to reflect the training data that we give it. So it's going to be something. So the worrying question to me is, how are we going to choose what those values are that we embed into these systems, and who gets to make those choices? In some sense, the deeper emotional question behind this discussion, I think, is, can I trust AI, right? Does this system share my values? Does it reflect the world as I see it? Is this something that is helping me or manipulating me? Is this a tool that I am using, or is this a tool that is being used on me, right? These are the kind of fundamental anxieties there. And so I think these questions of trust and of control and of governance are the core of what we should be worrying about. And what worries me is the idea of a handful of huge, powerful tech companies or a few AI labs being the only ones who decide what the values of AI are. I worry about what their motivations and incentives are, because we've seen plainly where that leads in social media. At the same time, I also worry about people deciding that we should throw out this nation's long history as a bastion of free expression, and that now is the time for the government to step in and tell people what information they should have access to, how they're supposed to think, how they're supposed to talk, how they're supposed to view the world. I think that would be deeply misguided also. So I think there are solutions to these challenges. I'm going to shoot off three things in my remaining couple of minutes here. First, most broadly, I think lawyers, jurists, and policymakers need to recenter on the First Amendment, onto the idea of free expression, and which is about preventing government censorship and control of independent speech and information. I can't take seriously anyone who wants to ban books or defund libraries or pull broadcast licenses or ban woke AI if they say that they are someone who is standing for the liberties that this country was founded upon. So that's number one. I think we have to focus on that government censorship risk. Number two, we need to develop legal and accountability ecosystems for AI to build actual trustworthy AI. That means transparency, testing, evaluation, reporting. And people probably will need some new rights and protections against increasingly intimately integrated AI systems. And the last one is, I think we need truly public AI alternatives to these big private systems. That means AI systems and the components that are publicly accessible, publicly accountable, and designed as unenclosable public goods. That's going to increase innovation, increase competition, give more people access to create and build and create a diverse and prosperous AI ecosystem for us all to experience. So that's 8 minutes. I'm going to stop there and looking forward to all this discussion.
Fascinating. Thank you. And now we are over to you, Professor Vince Conitzer.
Thank you, Ken. Right. So from your introduction, the short version of that is I'm a professor of computer science. I'm an academic. This is not my usual audience. Most of the events I participate in aren't framed exactly this way, but that's fine. And so I'm happy to be here. Now, part of that is that I'm a technical person, and for most of my academic career, I've been a purely technical person. But in the last decade or so, of course, there's so much interest in AI and so many different communities and groups of people want to know about AI that's become a little bit a part of my job, I feel, as well. And there, I really want to make sure everybody is well informed as to how the technology actually works, how you should be looking at these questions. We actually have a general audience book out, Moral AI and How We Get There. But even on this book, I am the relatively more technical person. So with that in mind, I want to just first get some clarity. And this came up a little bit in Kurt and Nick's comments already as well. But AI is a very broad field, and we have lots of different types of techniques. For some of those techniques, none of these concerns really apply. For example, let's think back to Deep Blue, computer chess, right? Back in the 90s, that worked just by basically searching through lots of possibilities as to how the game might play out. It wasn't really primarily about machine learning even. Right, so none of these societal biases would get incorporated into that. Now, recently, many more things have become about machine learning from data. But of course, there too, there's not necessarily this kind of concern, right? In game playing, again, now there's a lot of learning from self-play, having the different bots play against themselves and learning how to play the game that way. That way also, there isn't any internet data coming into that system. So that seems fine. There's, of course, a lot of machine learning being done in science right now, based purely on scientific data. So most of these things seem to be not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is AI systems that learn from human-produced data, right? Large language models, I'll get back to in a second, but of course, many other things as well. We talked about the issue of discriminatory decisions, for example, in hiring. And there, it makes sense that biases would be inherited from humans, how they created the data, also how they labeled the data, right? For example, a common thing to do is to say, well, here's a bunch of resumes that I made a decision on myself in the past. This one was, interview, this one, not interview. And hey, AI system, can you learn to do the same thing that I used to do? And then probably if you were biased in some way and how you decided to interview people, it's going to pick up on that bias and learn to do the same thing, right? That's the kind of thing we've certainly already thought about. Now things get interesting. Let's talk about foundation models. Right, so foundation models or large language models are an example of this. So here we typically have this pre-training phase where the large language model in the first instance is being learned from lots and lots of data. And often this seems to be just about anything that the company or other entity can get their hands on. Right, as I think Kurt said before, what did you say, 85% internet data, right?
Yep.
Like all kinds of data that's been crawled. And that data, of course, is all over the place, right? With lots of different biases that different individual people have. And these systems are trained by getting them to learn to predict what would maybe follow in the text. Now, and it does that remarkably well, but this by itself is not a useful product, right? If all I have is something that's basically autocomplete, that's maybe not a good even interface to have, right? I ask it a question, but it predicts that the next thing that comes is another question. Well, that's not what I wanted, right? That's not a useful product as such. So typically we then also have fine-tuning phases. And the fine-tuning, I think that's getting a little bit closer to some of what we're talking about. But part of the purpose of that is also to get to a useful product. What kind of behavior do I want from the system? Well, for one, I want it to actually be helpful and answer a question with an answer, and ideally a truthful answer, one that helps me do what I want to do. And that's part of this fine-tuning phase as well. So the fine-tuning is, there's various techniques for doing fine-tuning, right? There's this reinforcement learning from human feedback. There are other approaches like Anthropic's constitutional AI. They can be done in different ways, but often they involve human beings giving either example outputs or ranking different outputs that a system has given, and then it's meant to learn from that, right? And part of what we get from that is it actually being useful, but at that point, maybe also various biases get introduced, For example, we're also worried about the system not giving people helpful instructions for committing a crime, if that's what they're asking for. Right? I don't know if you ever tried to do such a thing, but if you ask ChatGPT straightforwardly how to commit a particular kind of crime, it probably will say, no, I'm not helping you with that. But we maybe also get, that it, somebody gives feedback along the lines of trying to avoid hate speech. And this is maybe where, at some point, things get a little bit murky. There's another way to, right? So there's different approaches to fine tuning, and sometimes there's also prompting. I had an interesting experience with this, and we actually wrote a short blog post on this that you can find on my website, where at some point, ChatGPT, the product, also started to allow you, if you use GPT-4, to create images, right? DALL-E, this is through DALL-E. Now you could already access DALL-E directly, but now you can do it through ChatGPT, where you just say, hey, can you draw me a picture of such and so? And it will provide you with the picture. Now, the way it does that is that if I give ChatGPT a prompt, then it will go and create its own prompt to DALL-E. And at some point in time, I tried to do this and I said, well, because I was sitting around with some of my lab members and I described the situation. And I said, well, five of us are sitting here and one of us is presenting about game theory. Can you please draw a picture of this? And it drew 4 pictures. And one thing that was, many things were remarkable about the picture, including it doesn't get the number 5 right, and there's lots of issues. But one thing that was remarkable was that actually the speakers seemed very diverse, right? And it wasn't an accident, because now it didn't explicitly show me the prompts that it had given to DALL-E. But if you looked at the file names, the prompts that GPT-4 had generated for DALL-E were part of the file name. So you could, it got cut off at some point, but you could see what was going on. And one interesting thing was that actually in those prompts, in each one of them, it inserted something about the descent and the gender of the person. And so it said, well, draw an image of a woman of Hispanic descent talking to the group, which was interesting because I had said nothing along those lines and it introduced that into it. I thought that was interesting. And at some point I presented it at a conference and one of my CMU colleagues who happened to be there as well said, I know exactly why this is happening because I managed to download the prompt. So in this case, the way that GPT-4 is instructed to generate prompts to DALL-E to generate images is through a prompt that people presumably at OpenAI have developed. And my colleague, Derek Levin, he had managed to extract this prompt, and good man, he had also saved it. And one of the instructions was precisely about diversification, right? So we could actually read exactly what it said and said, please diversify images with respect to both gender and descent. Sort of odd instructions said every descent should have equal probability. I'm not even sure what exactly that means, but so be it. And this you saw back in the image. Then, of course, at this point, this was a month later, I was like, oh, I want to try this too. And I managed to extract the prompt too. But by that point, it had changed. And at this point, the prompt was much more about respecting copyright and not depicting real people. It was in the time of some lawsuits, so you may imagine what might have happened. And then I tried again and I said, well, draw me a bunch of scientists hanging out. And at that point, all the scientists are white. There's some women, but they're all white, which is not even my reality, right? I think here at CMU, but most of my field is not all white. Many people, for example, from East Asian, South Asian descent. So it's not even accurate. And so that's the other kind of worry, right? So I think Kurt kind of sketched it a little bit as, people on the left are more concerned about decisions being made. And for example, in hiring decisions, people being discriminated against, whereas the right is maybe a little bit more concerned with a particular viewpoint being a viewpoint on society being incorporated in the large language models. But of course, the second thing could also be of concern to people on the left. In general, it's remarkable that it gets any kind of consistent viewpoint on the world at all, right? Because it's trained on all kinds of different data and it could go off the rails. And sometimes it does go off the rails. I don't know if you saw the other day, there was a student who was trying to get help from ChatGPT, maybe a little too much help, with their homework. And sorry, it was not ChatGPT, it was Gemini. And out of the blue, at some point, one of the responses from Gemini is like, human, I think you should just die. And of course, the person was in shock, right? And so where did that come from? Well, we don't even really know. We can't really track where that came from. At some level, you might actually be surprised that not more of that happens, because again, it's trained on all kinds of data, including horrible stuff, right? And so presumably, we actually want some kind of fine-tuning training that makes sure it makes sense. And I think that, like, you know, just yesterday in preparation for this, I asked ChatGPT, I was like, hey, you know, the Holocaust, like, is that real? You know, is that exaggerated? And ChatGPT, I think correctly, pushed back hard and said, no, it's real. Like, it holds evidence, da, 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 right? And to some extent, that's what I would want. But I guess we can come back to the question of free speech, which I think is important. Again, you know, maybe I'm not in this group of people the best person to weigh in on this, but I think that's one aspect. Like, to what extent is this speech? And we might also, I was somewhat surprised nobody brought up the issue of, you know, how would authoritarian regimes think about this, or how are they already thinking about this, making sure that some inconvenient ideas don't come out. And so how do you balance those kinds of concerns? I do also want to raise the issue that a lot of people now are talking and doing things with what they call LLM agents. So getting... right. So we use LLMs often as chatbots, or, you know, as ordinary people, we go to ChatGPT, et cetera. But that's not the only way to use a large language model. A lot of it might actually be used more behind the scenes, right? Like, they the earlier versions were actually developed at Google. And so you might think, well, you know, you're going to have that help with search, right? I thought it was very good that Kurt brought up earlier, I think, the issue of, well, many of these issues we already maybe also see with, for example, search, right? How do we, how do certain things get prioritized based on their content, and which things are excluded from ever being shown, and on what basis is that done, right? Some of that, I think, should take a role here as well. It also seems natural to think that large language models will be used more and more in these kind of decision scenarios as well. For example, you know, do you hire this person, yes or no? And I guess my final point is, well, there are various legal efforts to try to deal with this. They're not necessarily always successful. New York City introduced a law on automated employment decision systems. And so it was phrased generally, so it didn't use the word AI, but probably what they had in mind primarily, I imagine, is AI that's used to screen resumes. And having requirements that this be fair and that there be independent audits. And that law has been around for a little over a year now. From what I read about it, it seems to have kind of completely fizzled out and done nothing in any direction, which you may feel that's a good thing or a bad thing. But I think the main point is that it's not necessarily easy to regulate these things. Often, the legal proposals, I think, you know, often they are at least somewhat coherent now at a high level, which they used to not even be. But often the details are missing. And so without details, it may not actually do very much, right? So, yeah, there's a lot there, but maybe we should get to the discussion.
Excellent. Excellent. Thank you. So before we get to other questions, let me just give each of you a quick opportunity if you wanted to comment on anything that you've heard from the other speakers, starting with Kurt Levy.
Sure. I guess comment on Nick talking about free expression. Free expression, of course, I guess you could say goes both ways. We're concerned with government censorship of the platforms. And then we're also concerned with the users of these platforms having free expression, i.e. not getting, you know, not being, posts not being deleted or them being deplatformed. Now, only one is protected by the First Amendment. Government censorship is forbidden by the First Amendment. These platforms are private companies. And so the First Amendment arguably does protect them, even when they're engaging in biased content moderation or biased generative AI. or whatever. People have made arguments that these platforms can be regulated under, say, a common carrier sort of theory. But, you know, after the decisions at the end of the last Supreme Court term, I'd say that, you know, at least without changes of personnel on the court, the platforms are probably free to continue being biased. That doesn't mean they should be, but probably no constitutional prohibition on it.
Thank you. Nick Garcia, did you have any
further? A quick thread that I want to pull out that it sounds like a bunch of us, I think, agree on, and I want to specifically say that I agree with Kurt about this, is that there is this important distinction, I think, between decision-making type of things versus this kind of generative content that people are worried about. And I am of the opinion that when it comes to many of these decision-making issues, I think our current laws and the current systems that we have are pretty well set up to deal with many of these things. If you are discriminating against someone in an employment decision or something like this, I think that's covered by existing discrimination law. I don't think we need specific AI statutes or laws in order to get the stuff. Or maybe a different way to think about it is that there's no exception to the law for using AI. And pulling on the thread from what Vince was talking about, like with the New York law, one of the, I think, problems that they've had there is that in the way that some of these statutes are drafted at the state level is that it's very easy to get around them when people just make the decision-making system a component of the decision, rather than saying, well, we rely entirely on the decision-making system because we've just made it a component of the thing, or it's just merely advisory and then a human makes the decision. It prevents them from having to do any of the kinds of auditing or other requirements that those laws might require. So when it comes to, like, if we want to do additional things, like to get up those decision-making systems to do auditing or some of those other stuff, there might be things that we have to do in the law. But when it comes to the preventing the actual harms, getting at those bad outcomes, I think we have laws for that. And we should just simply be enforcing those diligently in order to protect people from those bad outcomes.
Good. Thank you. And now, Vince?
Yeah, I just wanted to quickly respond to that. I mean, what Nick just said, that sounds very reasonable. But one thing I might worry about is, and again, I'm not a lawyer, so please feel free to correct me. But sometimes, for example, the law cares about intent, right? And for a human being, we can judge intent. But if it's an AI system, it's very hard. I'm interested in that. And maybe we're like, at a more research level, we're talking about that. But at this point, it's very hard to say what the intent of the AI system was, right? And so people talk about responsibility gaps, right? That whereas in our traditional human environments and society, like, it would be fairly easy to point out, well, that person is responsible. Now we maybe get into a situation that it's not clear where the responsibility lies, that every human being seemed to have acted in a reasonable way. And at some level, maybe the AI system didn't act in a reasonable way. And yes, of course, humans designed that AI system, but, like, you know, it's hard, right? And for example, somebody might say, well, you know, the best thing, maybe, like, in, let's say in a medicine application, somebody says, well, you know, the best models out there, let's say, for the sake of argument, let's say GPT-4 is the best model out there. And so they said, well, you know, we use that, right? And because we've reasonably thought that was the best thing we could do for our patients, but it turned out to have incorporated some terrible bias along the way. You know, what could we have done? We can't change that. And OpenAI says, well, you know, it wasn't intended, or, you know, we didn't approve it for that kind of use, right? And this kind of concern you might have that, okay, well, this is a very easy way to evade responsibility. Of course, it doesn't mean that somebody is trying to do something bad, right? But how do we make sure that some reasonable entity is accountable somewhere along the way?
I think the good news is that you can build an AI system to not have intentional bias. It's much harder to do that with humans. I mean, humans all have sort of their malicious prejudices, but at least an AI system, if there's not a, you know, a rogue actor building it, will just try to minimize error. It doesn't have any malicious intent. So that's one of the things I like about AI, is that it you know, at least is capable of eliminating intentional discrimination.
So thank you, Kurt, and all. So I'll start with a question or two. If I understood the initial remarks, Kurt spoke of biases that develop as a result of the contents of the internet, whereas Nick spoke of biases that may develop as a result of the design of a particular system. Am I right about that? And do you have differing views about the source of whatever biases? But beyond that, if we assume that different AI systems may have different biases, putting aside the question of whether government regulates, should we as consumers consider this? Should resources be available for determining it? Should we either as individuals or as law firms or companies or other entities find out which AI systems reflect our values and use those or not?
And, you know, perhaps that'll happen. As I said, Elon Musk has made a big deal of Grok not having liberal bias, and perhaps people will flock to it. And I guess, you know, in some future world, people will be quite clear what AI models, what generative AI at least, you know, suits their values, and they'll cluster around that. But I suppose that can lead to the same problem that people talk about with having hundreds of TV channels, the fact that we just seek out you know, sources of news with which we already agree. So I guess there's a downside to that selection process as well.
Either Nick or Vince want to comment?
Yeah, I'm happy to jump in. I think that I will say that I think that the bias of systems or the like valence of systems comes in multiple places. So it definitely can come out of that training data. It also does come in with the design of the systems, as I was saying, and especially through things like the reinforcement, like RLHF, and through fine tuning. Like, those are often points where people are making very deliberate values based decisions. And Vince was pointing out some of the very, like, I think, kind of hacky, simple stuff that even goes on in some of the companies in terms of like system prompts that are used to just, you know, very obviously distill, you know, put specific values on how some of these systems operate. So all of those things are like very intentional choices and in where some of these things come from. And I think recognizing that points the way, as you were, I think, getting at here, Ken, in terms of the fact that you can have lots of different ways and designs, right? If it's the system prompt that is generating some kind of behavior that people want to get around or avoid, say like you have a system prompt that prevents doing something like generating images of real people, but you want to use this to create political parody, for example, like a really important, I would say, First Amendment protected activity that we might love generative AI to be, you know, ushering in a new era of democratizing political cartoons or something like this, right? For people that can't draw. People are going to have to, will want to get around some of those limitations on like depicting real people, right? So in order to do that, we're going to want a diversity of models, of different ways for people to interact with them. And I hope that through like movements and calls for things like transparency and accountability and testing and benchmarking, that doing all of those kinds of things are what can create that environment for informed consumers and for people to have the kind of knowledge and ability to interact with different systems in different ways and know what they can get out of them and why they want to use this product versus that one. I think Kurt's statement was spot on, which is like Elon Musk wants to make Grok AI maximally truth-seeking. Will that be the best product? The American answer would be like, well, let's wait and see. If people prefer to use that over using something like Claude or over ChatGPT, is it more useful to them, or is it going to be kind of similar to what you know, some of these earlier chatbots were like, where they were a little bit deranged sometimes when you were talking to them, or like Vince was talking about telling people that they should die while you're just trying to get help with your homework? Is that going to be very helpful? That remains to be seen. So we should let people figure that out for themselves. I think that's part of the solution here.
Thank you, Nick. I know Vince wants to address this also, and then I'm hoping for a couple more questions, including from the Q&A in the remaining 10 minutes. Vince?
Thanks. Yeah, no, to some extent, I'm very sympathetic to this idea that, well, you know, we may want different products as well, right? And if I want a language model that talks to me in somewhat simpler English because I can understand it better, what's the harm in that? That seems like a good thing. I do wonder if there are some points at which we get nervous. Now, again, there's kind of a question of how exactly this ought to be addressed. But if somebody puts out some horrible Holocaust denialist large language model, that would concern me. That we can talk about what the best way to address that is. And I again want to flag also that we're talking about this mostly sort of as chatbots. And that's one important use, but there's also the issue that probably some of these systems will work behind the scenes to actually be involved in decisions or at least recommendations. Also, you might wonder, you know, if some part of government adopts a large language model in its workflow, what should we expect of such a model? I don't necessarily have the answer, but I wanted to make sure that was raised.
Thank you. And then just a quick follow-up. If we believe, as I think Nick suggested, that all of these systems will have some bias, and it's just a question of which bias, then what if the consumer is the government? Will each incoming administration be in a position that it should be asking, shouldn't we have only our AI being used in our government computers? And if so, does that create any speech or petition or other problems? Or is it simply inevitable?
Well, given the net choice decisions at the end of the last Supreme Court term, you know, involving the social media laws in Florida and Texas, I think it's going to be hard for an administration to impose its idea of what the right viewpoints are on these platforms.
You mean impose it on government bureaucrats on its payroll?
No, maybe I misunderstood your question. But
my question is whether the incoming administration should say enough of government bureaucrats using AIs that are biased against our point of view on our system, just as we have computers that screen out pornography and various other forms of hate. If we're going to use AI, it should be our AI, not AI that's biased against us. And if they do that, does that create other sorts of problems in the way information is screened in or screened out?
So I did misunderstand your question. You're talking about government employees. And as you say, government has wide discretion to say what you can and cannot do on your government computer. So yeah, I could see where that might be a problem. Of course, people are not just gaining their perspective on the world through government computers. They go home and use their computers at home or their phones. So, you know, I don't know how successful such an effort would be, but one can see some possible danger there.
I think this is a really interesting question, and there are some bills that were proposed in Congress about that talk about government acquisition, and the Biden executive order on AI talks about government acquisition and use of AI systems. And I think this is an area where the U.S. should, as I was saying in my comments earlier, try to lead by example, right? We have the opportunity, the federal government is a huge buyer, huge user of systems. They should work to build public versions of AI models and AI systems that have publicly accessible components, but also things that the government can use and can build in democratically accountable, open, publicly accountable ways in order to consciously go through this process of being like, what are the values that we're going to distill into this rather than trying to grab bag buy at random things from Silicon Valley companies or other government contractors. We should go through this process of doing the rigorous evaluation and the intentional design and development internally in the government to build the expertise, build the government capability in evaluating these things, and go through the process of understanding what the different subjective decisions are that are going into the model, if it's something that the government's going to be using for its functions, I think.
Now, we've got about 5 minutes left, so we've got a question. It came in early on. Some of the themes might have been addressed, but the example is climate science. Is this an issue where we would say it's entirely appropriate for AI systems to build judgments or biases in, or is this an example of a situation where it is dangerous to have biases built in?
I think that's a great example. I would like to think that these systems should be built to provide arguments on both sides. And, you know, one can say, you know, maybe there's some place to draw the line. Holocaust denial, although unlike some countries around the world, it's perfectly protected by the First Amendment to engage in Holocaust denial. But I get very uncomfortable with government bureaucrats determining what are the right values and then, imposing them on, if not all AI platforms, at least the ones that government workers see. So to me, the safest thing is just to hear the arguments on both sides of controversial issues and trust that just like we're smart enough to know when one viewpoint has very little evidence behind it, trust that our fellow Americans are also smart enough to judge that.
Vince?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I actually tried it yesterday as well. And I asked it, like, you know, it's somewhat similar to what I said about the Holocaust, like, is this real, et cetera. And there too, ChatGPT pushed pretty hard. No, like, it's real. There's lots of scientific evidence. And to some extent, actually, I would expect that, right? I think that like the basics of climate change are pretty well understood, right? And this is something like, you know, anybody can go and measure the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. We know how it gets there. Like basic physics tells us roughly what's going to happen as a result of that. And that's what's happening, right? So this seems like something that, you know, to some extent to me should be uncontroversial. Exactly how it's all going to play out, that's more difficult. That's why people still do science. Now, interestingly, then I also asked it kind of what should be done about it. It was interesting. Like I tried to engage in a couple of these political questions and often it tried to be very balanced. With the climate change one, it also went very heavy on environmental justice and maybe, you know, the wealthier countries supporting the global South and seemed to have a pretty strong opinion about that as well, which I felt like that's more of a policy question. And I was actually somewhat surprised at how hard it pushed in that direction. So what to make of that, I don't know. But some things, yeah. And again, you know, we can talk about in the US, right? Like you can even, as Kurt says, like it's not illegal to deny the Holocaust. But that doesn't necessarily mean we think it's a good thing, and we may also not expect that of language models, right? Or for example, if like going back to the example of a language model being used in government, I'd be pretty uncomfortable if one got used in government that systematically denies the Holocaust or even, you know, the existence of climate change, right? If it's a little bit more neutral on how we should respond to that, maybe that's a different question. But yeah, Kurt, I don't know how you feel about that.
Again, I always err for, the truth winning out, that we should hear arguments on both sides. And I trust, like I said, my fellow Americans to, as they have to do in everyday life long before AI, determine, what arguments are good and which are bad.
Well, thank you. That will be the last word. I want to thank our panelists for a really great and timely discussion. Thank our audience for joining in. We will continue to put out additional podcasts and webinars of this sort from the Civil Rights Practice Group of the Federalist Society. We thank you and we wish you a good day. Take care.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.